For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Guys, welcome to the Full Blast Podcast. I'm Jeff Fader, and guess who's here? Kay Foy. Are you crazy? This is unbelievable. Before we get into it, I want to take care of a little business. We got a lot to cover. First things first, I want to thank my friends at Broadbeck Ironworks, makers of the 2x72 grinder. This grinder is amazing, and it has changed the way I make knives. Not to mention, if you're a knife maker, if you're removing any material, this is the grinder for you. And if you go to broadbeckironworks.com, put in the promo code KNIFETALK10, you get 10% off everything, the grinders, attachments, parts, all that stuff. Highly recommend. I'm with you. Next are my friends at Even Heat. Oh, I love these guys. Even Heat is the manufacturer of the finest heat treat ovens available. To get your next oven, go to evenheat-kiln.com. Get the tap control. I promise you, it'll make your life easier. Get yourself that solid state drive to make sure you're on the money in regards to when you need to be. If you're using stainless, if you're heat treating stainless, if you're heat treating Baker Forge, anything you're heat treating, this is the one for you. And if you're doing a glass blower, if you're a potter, this is the one for you. Get yourself an, if you're trying to get something hard, this is the one for you. Evenheat-kiln.com. Next are my friends at Maritime Knife Supply. Lawrence Lake is my hero. He's unbelievable. And if you all your knife making needs, belts, abrasives, steels, kilns, forges, press, heat treating ovens, all that stuff. They're in Canada, but they ship to the United States with ease. And if you're a Canadian and there's something that you want, you should get a hold of Maritime Knife Supply because he's one of the greatest facilitators in the biz. He's also a knife maker. He's also very involved with the schools. I'm very excited because he is going to be involved with a place that I hold dear to my heart, the Center for Metal Arts. He's already been involved with the New England School of Metalwork, and he is a incredible resource and part of the knife making community. So go to maritimeknifesupply.com, and when you get a 10 pack of abrasive belts, you get 10% off. And I highly suggest you get the Norton Razor Star 36 grit belts. You're welcome. That's what you need. Next are my friends at Trojan Horse Forge, makers of the Stable Rail knife finishing vise. This is the knife. This is a vise. I'm going to talk to Kay Foy. I think that she needs a knife vise like this, and I'll tell you why later. It is unbelievable. It holds your blades in place. It also is great for hand sanding, but it is amazing. And if you go to TrojanHorseForge.com, not only do they sell the Stable Rail knife finishing vise, but they have classes. They sell knives. They sell all sorts of stuff. It's a great company. And if you go to TrojanHorseForge.com, put in the promo code FULLBLAST10, you're going to get 10% off everything. So I highly suggest taking a look at the Stable Rail knife finishing vise. I have a feeling that this is the knife vise for Kay, but I'll leave her alone for now. Next are my friends at Baker Forge. It's BakerForge.com or Baker Forge and Tool on Instagram for all your specialty knife steel needs. Are you crazy? Copper my, bronze my, sand my, mosaic Damascus? All this stuff, they constantly coming up with new stuff, including stainless clad San Mai. But it's not stainless clad, stainless core San Mai. Stuff is awesome. It's awesome. These guys are the best. And it's easy to work with when it comes. It's easy to use your lousy bandsaw, your angle grinder, whatever you need. And then when it comes to finishing, they tell you how to finish. They tell you how to not only do the heat treat it, they give you hold your hand on heat treatment, but they take care of you in regards to how to finish it. You know how they finish it? With their proprietary etching. What's that etching, you may ask? Of course, Gator Piss. That's the name of the etching. I didn't come up with the name, but I'll tell you what Gator Piss means. GATORPISS. Gator short for alligator. Piss is short for urine. This stuff is the best. Ain't nothing better than Gator Piss. And it's already mixed. It's all squared to go, all squared away. I use it for acid etching. I use it for etching Baker Forge stuff. I used it for Damasteel. I've used it for everything. It's dynamite stuff. And if you go to BakerForge.com. You can get 10% off when you put in the promo code FULLBLAST, or you can get it at my friends at Texas Farrier Supply. I love these guys, Texas Farrier Supply. This is actually where I get my Rhino wet. I go to TexasFarrierSupply.com, and then after I'm checking out my Rhino wet and my this and that and the other thing, they have all sorts of stuff. If you put in the promo code KNIFETALK10, you're going to get 10% off at Texas Farrier Supply. Get your gator piss there, too. Huge fans of the Texas Farrier Supply guys, and I appreciate the hell out of them. Next are my friends at Total Boat, totalboat.com/fullblast. They make adhesive, paints, primers, polishing compounds, all that stuff. I use their two-part epoxy, and I love it. I love it because it's great. It's boat. It's Total Boat. So people talk about marine grade. It's in the name, Total Boat. It's with you. I'm there with you. They're making sure these boats float, so it's going to work. I love the UV Cure Clear Resin, and I love their Fathom Thick Set Epoxy, too. If it's good enough for Keith Deason, Derek from Alden, Keith Johnsey, Keith Mitchell, and that scoundrel Jimmy Duress, it's good enough for you. So go to the affiliate code, or go to the hyperlink wherever you're listening to this, and if you follow totalboat.com/fullblast, it's going to give me street cred, and it's going to give you a discount. But street cred for me is kind of more important at this period in time. I love these guys at Total Boat, so get yourself involved with them. Next are my friends at Gil Hansen & Sons. That's G.L._Hansen & Sons. Its stuff is amazing. G-Card is a unique composite of natural fibers and fabrics mixed with epoxy under pressure with heat. Bofa, Ripple Cut, Tuxini, Mahi Mahi, Radio Worm Jakarta, Pheasant, Colorama, Hoopla. I know what you're saying. What is it? It's imagine they make canvas micarta, but they're not doing it flat. They're rolling around and turning it into like this big loaf, different colors and different shapes. And then they cure it, and then they cross-cut slabs of it, and then you end up with this stuff that almost looks like brain coral. It's amazing. So if you and trust me, you should go follow them on Instagram, gl.l_Hansen & Sons on Instagram, and then you can see it. And then when you go to jeepcarta.bigcartel.com, you can buy it. So that's the way to go. Amazing colors, razzle dazzle for your project, easy to work with. This is the stuff for you. I mean, you can't beat it. I love it. I have customers requesting different colors. They know him. So get on board with G Carta. And then I want to thank my friends at Tormek_sharpening on Instagram, Tormek.com. I love these guys, and I'm going to be seeing the guys at Tormek at Blade Show this year. I'm really excited they're going to be there. If you're listening to this and you're going to Blade Show, go over to the Tormek booth and go say hi. Go say, tell them Jeff sent you for sure. I'm actually going to be having Carl Friends, my buddy Carl from Tormek, is going to be coming on soon. I love it. I use all my knives to get sharpened with Tormek, and I can't say enough good things about not only the machine, but the customer service is beyond reproach. I love these guys. So if you want to check out Tormek.com, or you can even send me a message at Full Blast Podcast on Instagram, and I'll tell you my feelings on it, because I'm an ambassador, if you can believe that or not. But I'm with you. I'm with them. Next are my friends at Nordic Edge. That's at Nordic Edge on Instagram. NordicEdge.com.au. They're in Australia, and they not only do they sell you amazing products like their screw-on file guide, which is unbelievable, but they teach classes. They have knife making classes, they have leather working classes, blacksmithing classes, and they got real guys, real good instructors there. Sausage Man, Forge, Bjorn, all those guys are amazing. So what happens is when you go there and you support them, what you're doing is you're supporting a great community, especially in Australia. I mean, they got an amazing community down there, and they're highly recommended by good friends of mine who are some of the best knife makers on the planet. So they have the guidance to help you accelerate your creativity and the tools, products, and supplies to manifest your ideas. So go to NordicEdge.com.au, stop playing, and go tell Sausage Man Forge I said hello. That guy is unbelievable. And last but not least, I want to welcome aboard Phoenix Abrasives. We're in a weird time where things are becoming more expensive, and we're trying to figure out ways in which we can save you money and on belts and abrasives and stuff like that. I got you. You're going to go to Phoenix. You're going to go to phoenixabrasives.com. You're going to buy anything you want there. They supply superior abrasive products for every application: knife making, metal fabrication, glass fabrication, floor sanding, and crankshaft. Whatever the hell that is, They're supplying you. Got it? I mean, crankshaft. I mean, that's enough. I mean, if you can't make it happen with crankshaft, I don't know what you need. They have awesome belts for grinding. They have cutoff discs. They have flap discs. They have surface conditioning belts, all that stuff. And you're going to buy whatever you need for your crankshaft or for your knife making. For me, I'm going to get some belts. And then at the end, you're going to do is you're going to put in the promo code FB10 at the checkout, and you're going to get 10% off. 10% off these days is important. So I highly suggest go to phoenixdebrasives.com, and you can, wherever you're listening to this, all of the links and all the promo codes, all that stuff is here, so you don't have to send me a message saying, hey, I don't know where it is. Don't worry. Wherever you're listening, go scroll down, baby. I'm with you 100%. So Phoenix Abrasives, welcome aboard. We're 100% behind you. I really appreciate the fact that you're offering up a discount for my listeners. That means a lot to me, and especially all the sponsors for the show. And I appreciate the hell out of you. Now, without any further ado, my friend Kay Foy is an incredible knife maker. I've known about Kay for quite a long time. And what is fascinating to me is the fact that her work as a knife maker is influenced by her experience as a ranch hand and a wrangler. But it's also influenced by her memories and the things that she finds in history, and not to mention the sentimental items and thoughts of her customers, which makes her a very unique person in the knife-making world. And I'm so happy to have you. Kay, how the hell are you?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm so glad you're here.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
I've been a fan of yours for quite a long time, and I was telling you before we started recording, I had such a good time researching, reading articles, and watching videos on what you're doing.
Thank you.
Your work is putting me in a bad position.
Oh no! Why?
Because for years, on Knife Talk and on here, I've always been of the mind that knife making is not art. And that knives are not sculpture. And it's basically a very, very easy, when I started with Knife Talk, I really needed a good controversy that people wouldn't be, it wasn't such a controversy that people were going to throw bricks through my window. You know what I mean?
Right.
This is an easy controversy. Yeah, people get a little hurt here and there, but you know,
totally.
I usually score my way out of it. But when I look at your work and I see your intentions, and I see the body of your work and how you've gone about it all. It's one of the closest methods of sculpture I've seen in the knife making world.
Oh my gosh! Well, that's quite the compliment. Yeah, I have found that for me, the knife handles have become kind of a canvas. I guess that's the best way to explain it. It's just this like free space to create something outside of the steel, which is also, I mean, equally as important, but. It's this mix between, you know, like with the blade and the blacksmithing and the blade work, everything is precise and scientific and everything has to be symmetrical. And we're looking at temperature, we're looking at pressure that we're putting on and the different grits that we're using and making sure like everything is precise. And then all of a sudden, you know, you go through this like very... it's not sterile, but it's like a very methodical work. And then I get to the handle and it's like my brain just explodes with curiosity and I guess creativity. And it's this really interesting duality of, I don't know, going from like one side of my brain to the other side. So it's been interesting little pathway into this knife making world.
You know what? I'm really glad too, because actually, you posted something yesterday on your stories, and it was basically like a time lapse of how you put your handles together.
Yeah.
And for the listener not knowing Kay Foy's work, if I were to describe it as describe it the way an art reviewer would describe your work. The knives are based off of kind of a Western style belt knife. Usually a lot of them are made with rasps, and there's we got to talk about that too.
Yeah.
And then the handles themselves there's an artist, this might be tough for some of our listeners, but you're going to have to do a little research, guys. There's an artist named Gustav Klimt.
Oh my gosh, yes.
And Gustav Klimt was famous for doing these paintings. There was an opulence to these paintings. Lots of gold leaf, lots of these, but it wasn't traditional opulence like the way you would see, like with scroll work and like very. It was implied opulence. And when I look at your work, I cannot help but think about Klimt, because your work has so many parts to it. There's like it's almost like this incredible story in the handles themselves. And when you take these opulent, you know, some things, it looks very Southwestern to me. Like a lot of it mm-hmm. looks like, but when I say Southwestern, I'm talking about like, I don't know, like a mesa. There's sure. a lot of the colors are very much along the lines of these kind of Southwestern colors. And you get pieces of wood from these different trails. Yeah. And then there are these colors and these blues and these, you know, yeah. but there's this very conscious opulence, but it's like implied.
I'm a little speechless that you even brought Klimt up, because his work, ever since I was a really little girl, I mean, I didn't know that I was quote unquote creative until I was 33. Huh. So that was like less than 10 years ago. It was 9 years ago. And I just remember seeing his work, and, you know, I just saw pieces, like, it was a piece of work, but within the piece, there was all of these other little pieces
right.
and then, you know, the mosaic. And I was always also really drawn to, there's an Italian style of jewelry making where they take all these tiny little pieces of ceramics and porcelain and things like that. And then they piece together, you know, flowers and this like very ornate jewelry. And I was always just very fascinated by all of that. But Klimt specifically, and his use of gold has become sort of a theme for a collection we can talk a little bit about later on. But it's all based around using gold to weave together pieces on the handle for this collection called A Collection for a New Beginning. So
So the other thing, I was talking to my wife, and yeah. I was talking to my wife, we were walking the dogs yesterday, and I was kind of like all very excited about having you on and kind of explaining to her about your work and stuff like that. And I showed her that I think that the interesting thing is I think that I was so fascinated that I've seen your work for years, and I'm so fascinated how you did that time lapse you put up yesterday was like mind blowing, because it really does give the knife maker and the viewer a look into how you put your knives to get your handles together. And it's like, I was explaining to her, I said, you know, it's kind of like a collage. Mm-hmm. And that's why I was making the connection with Klimt too, because you have these collage like qualities when you're putting the handles on. You know, usually a knife maker, when they make a handle, they'll create the scales and then they'll put the scales together. You know, if let's say you just have a piece of wood and then
right.
you cut the, you know, you have your wood and then you slice it down the middle, you make sure they're flat, and then you kind of, you know, tack them together, and then you cut the outline out, and then you kind of figure out a way to kind of put them together.
Mm-hmm.
The way you put your handles on is you're almost like, it's almost like you're tying a fly.
Yeah.
And you have.
Which is so hard.
Pardon me?
It's so hard to tie a fly.
I know, but I mean, it's the same kind of concept. Is like you have the knife being held, and that's why I think you need a Trojan horse knife finishing device.
Yeah, we need to. I need to look this up.
Because it holds the knife. I don't want to mean this isn't like an infomercial, but it basically, because I started to think it's like, because I have, you know, you have your hand, you have the knife, and then you have tweezers, and then mm-hmm. you have all your, you know, all your parts, and we have to talk about all the parts, because all the parts have meaning, and
mm-hmm.
you're using, you know, CA glue, and then you're using tweezers, and you're placing things so, and then you're building on to the handle, as opposed to creating the scales and then fitting the scales to the knife.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's like kind of the biggest, I mean, maybe I don't want to say misconception, but I think when, you know, cause like you said earlier, traditionally, knife makers, you know, we have scales and we put them on.
Right.
And,
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save.
$20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Where the idea to do all this really came from was I had done an apprenticeship with Jake Sweet down in Cleveland, Georgia, back in 2019. And it was short-lived. He was getting on the road to do a bunch of shows, but I got to spend a couple months with him, and I had never touched a belt grinder before. I had like no idea what I was doing. I just wanted to buy a knife from Jake. And wow. I saw him at a really amazing high-end store, Kemosabe in Aspen, and he was doing a trunk show there. And I was getting ready to go to Alaska for the summer, and I really, really wanted to take like a special knife with me. So I was at the store, and Jake was doing a trunk show, and Jake uses, I mean, I was so fascinated. He was using Harley Davidson chain and forging it into the steel to create these blades. I had never seen anything like it. And he was also using bear jaw and just all of these really exotic pieces in the handle. And so I spent hours with him and his wife just asking these questions. I'm like, what's this and what's that? So long story short, I ended up going down to Georgia and apprenticed with him. And, you know, what's crazy is like, I worked in fashion in New York City in my 20s. Like I didn't know anything about the utilitarian purposes of a knife until I was working with horses out west. And like, you have to have a knife on you all the time. And, So I went down and learned how to use two by 72 inch belt grinder. I mean, I was wowed. I would sit and just watch him create these billets for his Damascus on, you know, big old power hammer. And I felt like I was transported into an entirely different world. But Jake uses materials much like I do that are, you know, really exotic. But my job to start off with him was to basically square off pieces of material. And so I was taking all sorts of live edge wood and antler and things like that. And I was like squaring it down and learning how to use the sanders. And as I got a couple of months into this, you know, Jake was like, okay, like you have to find your voice. Like you have to find what your aesthetic is in this craft. And I was like, what do you mean my voice? Like, I've been doing this for like 3 months. Like, how am I supposed to know what my voice is? And so I sat there for a couple of days and I just thought a lot about, you know, this concept of being creative and it not just being taking something and just placing it on the handle and not really putting a lot of thought into it. And one day I was on one of the bandsaws and I was cutting off those live edges that I had just talked to you about. And I was tossing them in the garbage. And I was thinking about my experience and seeing Jake's knives for the first time. And I remember thinking, how does he know what each material is? And then as I'm throwing out the live edges of these things, I was like, that kind of like tells a story of what this, like it gives a hint into what these materials actually are. So I asked him, I'm like, hey, do you mind if I like grab all this stuff out of the garbage? And he was like, yeah, okay, kid, like whatever. And so I just started collecting all of the cutoffs of all these things. And then one night I sat up late in the shop and I just took these scraps and I started piecing them in. And I was using, there's really great glue called Paleo Bond, which paleontologists use to put fossils back together. And it comes in all different viscosities, but I was playing around with it and using turquoise and crushed rock and all sorts of things. And that's sort of how it came to be was I just started seeing the way the shapes of these raw materials would fit in a way that made sense to me. And then I would fill everything in with inlay. And so that's kind of how this, I guess my voice came to be. And then later on, I started using materials that had meaning to my clients, in lieu of just random cutoff materials to tell their stories.
I'll tell you something that really kind of blew my doors off is that, you know, I was a steel sculptor. I usually knew steel before I started making knives. I've been a sculptor for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm very involved with the Center for Metal Arts, which is very involved with art, you know. And I have all these long conversations with Pat Quinn, the director of the Center for Metal Arts, and you have him on once in a while. And when we talk about art, especially metal art, or my friend Leah Arapach, who comes on every so often. When we talk about metal art that's directly with metal, one thing that we always are very aware of, and that's just because you're metal workers, you know, whatever, is the hard part about when you're making sculpture with found objects. What happens is when you use a found object like chain or something in the sculpture you welded in, you never lose the history of that object. Mm-hmm. Like in the sculpture, you're usually never transforming it out of, you know, its history. And mm-hmm. I always think to myself, for the sculpture that I make, I need to clear the history of the objects that I'm using, and I tend to not. I want the vision of what I'm doing to be so, focused that I don't want found objects to detract from the viewer. So you end up, you know, thinking it's something that it's not. And a lot mm-hmm. of metal workers feel the same way. There's some metal workers who love found objects. You can think about David Smith, or there's other sculptors over time that use found objects. And then Lee Tribe is an old mentor of mine. He would have junk and he'd weld it together. You know, there's a pile of them. But the problem is sometimes you don't want that story told. And then what's interesting to me is, for you, that story is so critical to the pieces. That because it's not just about the knife, it's about the history of the material.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, when I started, I'm just like a very curious person. And so, right. You know, knives, it wasn't something that I was like, oh, I want to be a knife maker. It just sort of fell into my lap. And I'm also kind of the person who's much of my life, I would say up until about 8 years ago when I found knife making, I was like, oh yeah, I'll try this. Like, I'll do this. I mean, I mentioned earlier, I worked in fashion. I was a yoga instructor. Like, I did all these things. And then all of a sudden I found knife making, and it was the first time that I really connected to something that I was like, oh, I don't quite understand this. But what I loved when I started doing research about knives and the meanings behind it and all of that is that, you know, it's the most primitive survival tool known to man. Well, how cool is that? You know, and then you start looking at all these artists who I call blacksmiths, bladesmiths, everybody's an artist to me that's creating something. But I started looking at all of these knife makers and everything that they were doing. And yes, it's all the same tool that we're creating, but everybody's has their own, I don't want to overuse the word voice, but I mean, everybody has their own like aesthetic, you know, and you can sort of tell whose is whose based off of the way that the knives look. And so the history of the knife was really interesting to me, because as I started to use materials for my clients, which really wasn't like a novel idea, it was just kind of out of necessity. You know, I had left this apprenticeship and I was like, well, I'm not done. I still want to make knives, you know? And so it was like, well, shoot, like I had it like with what, how am I going to do this? And so there was a guy who I had met who wanted to commission me to make a knife. And this was very early on. I was like, are you sure? Wow. Well, I've been doing this for a couple months. I met him at a motorcycle show in North Carolina. And he gave me a piece of wood that his father had gotten from Guantanamo Bay. And it was gorgeous, gorgeous, like ebony, just really, oh God, it was like the most dense wood I think I've ever worked with. Mm. I'll have to send you a picture of it. But that's kind of how the idea came to be. It was like, well, I don't really have the materials, but they have materials, and this is kind of cool because it tells a story. And then it just came to be that now I'm using the knife handles as a canvas to do some storytelling, and through all of that, and after a handful of years of using materials from my clients, I realized that it kind of came back full circle, because just through life and connection and realizing how important connection is, human connection is, I realized that not only are knives the most primitive survival tool known to man, but so is human connection. And so it was just this, I don't know, it just kind of became this thing where I was like, all right, I need to stick with this and I need to figure out how to make this work, because not having knife scales, you know, so I think some people think that I just kind of drop everything into an epoxy and, but it's as you mentioned earlier, it's not quite that. It's more of individual pieces that I stay, like I go through the whole stabilization process as you would with any wood or anything like that. But then it's individually placed on, and then by the time I'm done with it, it's a tool that you use to create memories, filled with memories that you continue to make memories with.
It's number one, it's the most unique way I've seen of putting a handle onto a knife. And that's and that's the highest compliment I can give you.
Thank you.
And I wonder, do you find it to be a burden how should I say this? Do you find that when somebody gives you something very sentimental and they want you to incorporate it into your knife, especially like this wood from Guantanamo Bay or these specific things that these, you know, these requests, do you find it to be a burden that you don't want to disappoint the customer? Because some of these things are, you know, some of the things you get are so personal to them.
Yeah.
Does it make you nervous that, what if I screw this up, or I hope they like it, or this is such a giant, you're put in a position of incredible faith.
Yeah. I mean, it's been an honor and honestly a privilege that people send me the things that they do. I mean, I've worked with everything from, one of the sweetest things was there was this client that I had who wanted to make a gardening knife for his wife. And so he had all of his kids collect things that had meaning to them and their mom. And so they sent me a package that had a piece of broken pottery from their mom's favorite coffee mug that had broken, and they, you know, she didn't want to part with it, but they couldn't figure out how to put it back together. And, and a dragonfly wing. I mean, that was like the first thing that like really kind of blew my mind, was I was like, okay, here we go. You know, I'm stepping into this, like, can I do this? Like, what if I can't do this? I've worked with ashes, like human and animal, a lot of horse hair. And, I just recently finished one with a, grizzly bear claw, a pair of jeans, like the pocket of jeans from my client's wife's jeans that she wore on their first date. Because, you know, he's just like, that's just was his like first memory of her. Flowers from their wedding bouquet. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on. And at first it was really daunting. And I was kind of like, what did I get myself into?
Yeah.
And then you just, a lot of it is after you get to know the client and you talk with them and you hear their stories. And I always tell them, because I don't know. The only thing I can tell you for sure that like it's going to be exact is what the knife is, the blade's going to look like. But as far as the construction of the handle, that just kind of comes to me as I go. And so I do my work and they leave me in peace, which is really kind of them. Yeah. And it's prefaced with, listen, like, I don't really know how this is going to, like, aesthetically how this is going to look, but if you have colors you really want me to emphasize, or a piece of the material you want me to use more of or less of, and then by the end of it, I'm happy to make any kind of changes that they want. You know, like, this is something that's really important to them. So if they see something, I always say, if you see something, you know, say something. I'm not offended by it. It would be really difficult for me to send out something and have a client not like it. And so that helped lessen, to long-windedly answer your question, that helped to lessen the pressure, because it became a process of creation between me and the client, which, you know, commissions can be tough. But this kind of gave me the freedom that I needed to create, and then the safe place for them to be able to say, hey, Kay, like, this doesn't quite feel right. And I'm so happy to do it. So no, I mean, it's not as... I don't feel as much pressure as I did before. I'm in my eighth year of it now. And so now it's just an honor, really, to be able to do this with them and to have them feel like they're a part of the creative process as well.
And it's very generous of the people who are commissioning you.
Totally.
Like, that is, I think that that's one of the most, I think that you should see that as one of the highest, unconscious compliments. That they give you these objects that have incredible, I mean, the flowers from the bouquet of their wedding, these objects that are like irreplaceable. They have the sentimentality that's irreplaceable, and they have the generosity to you to give them to you and say, do your thing.
Totally.
That's incredible.
It is. It's amazing. And I've moved my shop. This is like the eighth time I've moved my shop, and I will be moving it quite a few more times in this upcoming year for work specifically, but It just, everything gets put into glass jars and everything is, you know, numbered and it all goes in a book and I know exactly what's what. And so when the time comes to create, everything is like really safe and it just kind of comes and bops around with me everywhere I go. So, I mean, how generous they are to, I mean, not only are they just sending me materials, it also takes them a lot of time and effort and thought to go on these treasure hunts when they are considering like what can I take that has meaning and basically freeze it in time. I had one client, she said, "Kay, you make the invisible visible," because we're taking these materials that at first glance, you know, they may not really have a story or you wouldn't really know. And then all of a sudden, once they're combined with all the other things, then it's like this deeply personal tapestry of their story woven on the handle. And that makes it visible for them to be able to like tell the story. So it's deep. It's can be, you know, it can be a lot sometimes if you don't learn how to sort of disconnect when needed. You know, you have to like connect with the client to understand. And then sometimes depending on where you are in your own life and your own things that you're dealing with, you have to sort of disconnect a little bit and then reconnect to present the work. But it's such a privilege to be able to do this, and it's amazing how gracious people are with their time and trust to give me these things that are so sacred.
There's a couple things that I wanted to bring up. I have one problem with you in regards to you said I've only been being creative for you know, doing this for a couple of years, you know, or 8 years, whatever. And I feel as though, you know, we talk about being creative, the importance of being creative, but what we don't really address is you can be creative. I mean, I come up with like machine ideas. I wanted to do, when I was in the restaurant business, I had a product that I wanted to make. I didn't want to make it. I just told my friend as a joke, I want a machine that weaves pasta, weaves pasta into a plate, or be able to walk around like the pasta would be like almost like a, you could eat it on the street.
Yeah.
And I wanted to call it the noodle loom.
it's like a 3D printer for pasta.
That's creative. But I'd never built the noodle loom. You know, so like sure. I think being creative is fine. I think it's being able to execute creativity is where
sure.
it's at,
sure.
executing where it's at, and doing some kind of reading about you and stuff like that. What it brings me back to is I feel as though this was always meant to be. I really kind of want to like, I feel like your childhood had a huge upbringing, had a huge influence on your life and you today. And I feel like that's part of everybody's life. I think that their youth and the experiences they had have a huge experience. One of the things I loved reading about was when you were in New Jersey. You know, I know you said you've traveled around a lot. We're going to get into that. You used to go, when you lived in Princeton, you would go out into the woods, into the streams, and you'd always bring back these mementos of your trip. And what I loved was your mother would come up with these boxes and then she would give you these places to put these mementos. So every time you'd go out, and correct me if I'm wrong, you'd go out and you bring a rock back or you bring a stick back or a feather, something that kind of like it was a memento of the voyage. But then your mother was compiling them. What she was doing, not only just making a box for it, but she was allowing you to, she was reinforcing the importance of the things that you were finding on your journeys.
Yeah. You know, this timing of the podcast is really interesting. So I left my house when I was 16 and kind of just like bopped around and did all the things. And I just recently got back home 2 weeks ago. And I'm here for a short stint and I'm staying at my parents' Airbnb. And like, this is like the first time that I've been so close to home again. And my mom, she and I were having coffee the other day and she sets this envelope down and it's like a very belated, not very belated. I mean, Valentine's Day was just like, I don't even know, a couple months ago, but it was a Valentine's Day card. Yeah. And so in the card and I'm like reading it and she's like, and I really hope you like this box. And I'm looking around, I'm like, I don't see a box. So I don't say anything. And then she's like, did you even read the letter? And I was like, yeah, I read it. But I didn't like want to be rude and say anything about the box. And so she put the box down in front of me and she's like, look what I got for you at the thrift store the other day. It was like this beautiful porcelain vintage piece that, you know, is the tiniest little thing, but she's always wanted me to have, I guess, vessels to keep things that I collected, yeah. You know, and we moved to Princeton when I was, in high school, but when I was younger, I'm the oldest of three girls and my sisters are 5 years younger than me. And so I spent a lot of time just in the backyard, kind of like looking at rocks and flowers and, you know, lilac trees and just collecting things. And I mentioned earlier, I'm just very curious. And so, yeah, I mean, I do. I think a lot of my childhood and keeping myself busy when I was younger and being curious about nature, and there were these railroad tracks that were like up on this hill that I always used to go and explore and like pretend, you know, that I was off on some wild adventure, you know. And then we look back on my life in the last 42 years and it's like, wow, I'm still like kind of walking down those railroad tracks picking up stuff, putting them in boxes that my mom gave me.
Well, what I love is the relationship with you and your mom, because, you know, no matter what, when she's giving you these boxes, she's reinforcing her love of your experiences.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's, talk about generous. Absolutely. I mean, that what that does at a young age is that it gives children this confidence that the things that they're doing are not frivolous.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I to me, that I see that is part of this connection with your knife handles as well, is that you are, you know, it's almost like you and your experiences is of your mother saying, you know, this has value.
Yeah, okay? For sure.
And
for
that
sure.
This rock and this thing has a value. And then you're being able to transfer that onto these knives, and you're doing the same thing. You're taking these objects that to somebody might be nothing, you know, like a kid brings home a rock. Okay. All right. Go. Thanks. You know, I mean, well, let's be clear here. I mean, it's just like, you know, you that's awesome. Great. Congratulations. But at the same time, you're not going to go see your friend. You should have seen the rock my kid brought home, you know, but what you're doing is you're taking these little objects and that you're giving them that, gravitas.
For sure. And it's also, I think, you know, full circle again is, it's giving my clients, it's hard to even call them clients. I just want to call them all friends, but it's giving them the experience that, I guess it's the experience to look at the world in a different way and to figure out these like tiny little, like the rocks all of a sudden have all of this meaning, and maybe right. They wouldn't have had that meaning before. And being home during, you know, for these next few months, I get to spend some time with my nephew Palmer, who is four, and he came up to me yesterday and he was like, Kay, you could put this in a knife handle. You could put, look what I found in the garden, you know? And it's like, it's glass and it's everything now is like, well, let's put this in there. I mean, he gave me a golf ball the other day. He's like, can we put this in there? And so it's to see that innocent curiosity, that is like, it's in all of us. We just have to, sometimes as adults, we have to have a reason to do it. And so if I can offer that to my clients, to give them a reason to consider the world in a different way. Like, you know, I'm looking right now, I'm like looking at this container of toothpicks and I'm like, that might not have meaning, but like if maybe it could. And so can we put that into a knife handle? And all of a sudden you stop and you just become more present, I think is what I'm learning. And that wasn't my intention going into this. It wasn't like I was like, oh, I'm going to create something that's going to make people be this way. But what I've found is the gift in it is, we, even if it's just for a couple moments in time, where they're given a task to look around and see things a little bit differently, which is really important, I think, as we get older. And that's my dog in the background. I think that's, she's good. Agreeing with me.
She's agreeing with you. She's like, yeah, right, Kay. It's like, you're not like, you're too young to know Davy and Goliath. You know Davy and Goliath? When I was a kid, I loved Saturday morning cartoons. Uh-huh. And I would wake up too early, and they'd have this claymation cartoon, and this is the New York, New Jersey, tri-state area for some reason, I don't know why. There's Davy and Goliath, who was about this little, it was about this little claymation boy and his dog, and it was turned into some, like, you know, it was always like these very religious, and it was just like, all of a sudden my dad walks in the room, he's like, I thought we were Jewish. What are you watching here? And we only did the cartoons. But the dog would always talk to Davy, and it sounded like your dog, Davy. Unbelievable. So
she's very vocal, much like her mom.
Fantastic. She's fantastic. So here's the, what's her name, by the way?
So her name is Tutka. No one ever knows what I'm saying. They think I'm saying like taco or Tonka or something, but we call her Tootie. Just call her Tootie Lou. Sometimes Shaquita Benita. I mean, she'll really answer to pretty much anything. Tutty.
Wow. Yeah, that's what people do. Well, our dogs have all sorts of strange names. My wife is like the evolution of the names have become something that I joke around about. It's like this hop, skip, and a jump to something completely,
totally
different.
Totally. My most recent favorite has been Toots McGee. That's been a big fan favorite for her. So,
dog ownership is one of those things. Every time I walk my dogs every morning, and actually when I prepare for work, the walking the dogs has become my like preparation for the day. I think that the way you run your business and the way I run my business is different, and I'm far more. It's interesting as an artist. I feel as though I'm 51 and I'm very, very like completely comfortable with the fact that I'm not satisfied with any of the work I've ever done. I feel as though the direction of my work was unconsciously based off of fear of failure. And I ended up most of my work, my sculpture work, not Fader Knives, has been, unconsciously because I thought I was not believed. My parents didn't believe in me. My father was a painter and he says, this is a giant mistake. Don't be an artist. You're going to just fool around and this is no way to live a life. And I feel as though the directions that I took with my work were based off of fear. You know, they were far more commercial. Like the most of the work I've done over the years has been far more commercial. And that actually being able to sell my work has been able to make me keep doing more. And the more commercial it is, the more I feel it's this degree of, it's a validation in terms of, well, I better keep doing this, right? So when I'm walking the dogs, I was thinking about that. I think about when I walk the dogs in the morning, I'm very much along the lines of I'm constantly thinking about, number one, on the day of a podcast or a couple of days before a podcast, I'm thinking about which, where are we going to go with this podcast? I'm very competitive. And as I told you before we started recording, I am a little bit like Howard Stern Jr. in the sense that when I listen to other people being interviewed, I always think to myself, I've got to do a better job than that person. I'm not competitive about anything except for podcasting and radio. And it's a little bit like, it's hilarious. So when I'm walking the dogs, I'm always trying to think about what angle could I take that would be kind of more interesting for Kay or whatever guests I have. And what's interesting is with the dogs is every time I'm walking, I'm just usually like in contemplation. One dog sometimes don't walk with us anymore because she's a little difficult and maybe she doesn't want to walk and I just let her stay. And then when the smaller dog and I'll go for a walk and I'll be in real thought, thinking about not only what we're going to do on the podcast, but like I plan the days out in the shop. I have people working here. I want to make sure they're busy. I want to make sure everything's squared away. Right. I like to be as organized as possible. And every time I'm walking, I always have a sneer on my face. Like I look sour. I always look sour. That's like my lot in life. And every time I'm walking past the street and then there's a car comes and stops at the stop sign or whatever, they'll look at me and the dog and they'll smile at me. I don't understand. They're looking at me and I've got to get the Carhartt jacket on. I got a hoodie on. I'm scouring. I haven't shaved.
Super salty. Yeah.
I look like the wrong person to smile at, frankly. And I'm not saying it any other way that I'm just like,
Do you think they're smiling at you or at the dog?
I'm going to tell you why. So they're always, if I'm walking the dog and they see me, they'll always stop and they'll look at us and smile. And I figured it out. When you have a dog, people unconsciously think this person is capable of love. That's true. It's true.
I agree. I totally agree.
No matter what kind of garbage they are, that they don't even know. They don't even know the type of garbage that you possibly could be. But if you're walking a dog and the dog is walking with you and you're not, beating the dog up, obviously.
Right.
They think that this person is capable of love. And that's almost good enough to start.
I mean, it's a good I love that. I would feel like that's like a subconscious. It's like a subconscious smile, like a sweet, like, oh, he's not all bad.
Yeah, he's capable of love.
He couldn't shave today, and he's probably maybe, you know, hasn't washed his clothes in a couple of weeks, but well, he's capable crazy. Of love.
Don't get crazy with me, Kay.
Let's be honest. But... we all look like coal miners most of the time. I mean, I walked into a store yesterday after working, and you know, I had on ripped everything, and people don't get it. They think, yeah, whatever. Anyway,
but yeah, it's funny because like it's something that I've noticed over the years. I'm just like, it doesn't matter. If I'm walking the dogs, people will smile from their car. And it has to be this unconscious opinion of that person. And I even think to myself, what are you smiling about? In my mind, I'm thinking, why are they smiling? Like, you know, I'm from New York. You know, it's just like, just keep, totally. Keep walking.
What do you want?
Keep walking. Keep it moving. What are you doing? What are you judging me as totally. A good person for? Totally. And it's interesting because so I think about that with dog ownership all the time. But it's interesting when you talked about being in New York. And living in New York and living in New Jersey and in all over the place. I feel as though there's a lot of people I talk to who have moved around in their childhood a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of, you know, military, you know, kids of military families or for whatever reason, their families move around a lot. And what I've noticed is that there's this connection that I feel like you kind of fall into this. I feel as though that when kids are growing up and they move around a lot based off, you know, whether they're parents, whatever, regardless, is that it gives them the sense of being comfortable in these kind of uncomfortable situations of having to move on.
Right.
And what it translates to me to is bravery. Because I feel as though it's comfortable enough to kind of pick up and move, and it's brave enough to accept it and say, okay, let's go. And then I feel as though there are so many people who have this quality to them, and it all comes from this idea of like, you're going to school, you got new friends, you're doing your thing, and then all of a sudden you guys are moving to somewhere else, and that's just the way it is. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. Sorry, I put you on mute because my dog doesn't want to lay down, and I didn't.
All right. Okay.
Yeah, so yes, I do. I agree. I think that there is this really settling feeling that I get. I mean, I've moved all over the place. I lived in Alaska for a while, and I was in Colorado for a bit, and then I was down in Folsom, Louisiana, not where Johnny Cash, you know, sang his song about, but it was still an amazing spot right outside of New Orleans. And anyway, I find that it's instilled in me this need to like want to touch and see and taste and smell everything I can. Like there's so much out there that now when I get into these, I don't want to say stable, but these places where like I'm locked into a lease or, you know, whatever it is, that all of a sudden I'm like, oh, but like there's so much more out there that I want to go explore. I think there'll be a day where I'm approaching that day quickly where I'm like, oh, I'm ready to have a home. But for now it's like, I'll be on the road all year. So I will be here in Pennsylvania with my family until June. And then I have a plan to go up to New England for the summer. And I'm going to make a collection based off of the beach and, you know, do oyster shuckers and clam knives and, you know, use materials that you find on the beach. And then I'll be out in New Mexico for the fall. And so I'm not ready to stop the travel thing just yet.
No, but I feel as though with your business, I think that that concept translates to a bravery in terms of being a business person or being an artist. Because when you're an artist or a business person, you are vulnerable to a certain degree. And I think that, you know, we were talking about before in terms of finding your voice. I always refer to it kind of like as like with knife makers, some people have a fingerprint. So when you see it immediately, I'll just name off some people. Josh Prince, mm-hmm. Nick Anger, Salem Straub. There's a lot of European knife makers that when you see their work, you know it when you see it. You know?
Right.
And it's that, and you're falling into that category too. Like there's no, it's not as if anybody would be confused with your work with someone else. And I feel as though that gives you this position of bravery, because you are putting yourself in this position of vulnerability. I'll give you an example. Josh Prince is a friend of mine. I've known Josh Prince. You know Josh Prince?
Yeah, Joshua I Prince. Love his work.
Joshua it's Prince exquisite. Is unbelievable. Yeah. And I've known him I knew him in the beginning when he first started knife making. And I'll be honest with you, and he came from this family of sculptors. Mm-hmm. His father was a teacher, a professor at Rhode Island School of Design. Mm-hmm. He grew up where there was a table saw in the kitchen. They were making sculpture when they were making dinner. This is a real, went to galleries. He grew up living and breathing life as an artist. When he first started making work, he basically, did what a lot of, art majors who get into knife making do, is they're just like, no, well, fuck you. I'm not doing what you tell me. I ain't doing what you tell me. And what happens is in the beginning, I don't think that, and he and I have talked about this, I'm not saying anything that hasn't been said. When he first started making knives, I think that a lot of people really kind of not shunned him, but they didn't embrace his creativity. Mm-hmm. And now he's probably one of the most innovative bladesmiths in the country. No question about it.
So inspiring.
It took a lot of bravery for him, because he made himself in this vulnerable position. And I feel as though there's bravery with you, because it puts you in that vulnerable position too. I'm very excited about the fact that you're being able to go to places and do work that's site specific, because that's sculpture time.
Right, exactly. And it goes, it just kind of goes back to that. It's all curiosity for me. I'm like, can this work? Does this work? In college, I was a bio and psych major, but I was really drawn to the bio side of things. And so it's like, I kind of get to revert back to that scientific, thought process of, how is this going to work chemically? Is this going to work with the CA glue? Like, if I stabilize this, if I dry this out, is it too porous? To go to all these different landscapes, and to work with so many different kinds of materials, it feeds that scientific curiosity that I have, that sort of keeps me in more of a, I feel like there's two forms of creativity, like there's the one where your brain just goes overload and all the ideas come and it just sort of flows in. And then there's like the creativity that's like a bit more, you're using like empirical evidence to like do things in a specific way. So to go to these different landscapes and try out all of these different materials, it's all trial and error, but it feeds that side of it for me as well. So I can like lock it in on that creative level, and then I can let my brain go wild once I figured out like if this material works or doesn't work.
So thinking about when you're going, you're going to go to these kind of beach areas in New England and think about, when you're thinking about the kind of work that you're going to be doing out there, are you thinking about like, what are you going to find? Are you going to just stroll on the beach and collect beach glass and see what kind of things roll up? Or
yeah, I think it's a combination of a lot of different things. Like it's getting to know people, kind of like immersing myself in the community, whether it's going to restaurants or just, I'm a talker. So like, I'll talk to strangers and then all of a sudden, before you know it, you're hearing stories and like things that they're interested in, and you get ideas based off of that. So like, for example, the other day I was at a bookstore and there was this woman, we were just chatting and she was talking about this quilt that her grandmother had made. And my brain like immediately went to, oh my gosh, like, could I make carta out of the quilt? Like, how would that work? And so it's I'm inspired by materials that have meaning to people through conversation. And then I'm inspired by what I find as I'm in the very rare moments that I'm like walking down the beach or something like that. I've been really, really, really wanting to experiment with seaweed and like things that you wouldn't really normally think that you could make hard enough in order to like encapsulate and put into a knife handle. I'm really drawn to that right now. So like a lot of flower petals and things that are fine and thin or very porous, and figuring out how to stabilize it and make it into something that we can incorporate into handles.
That's got to be the tricky part.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot of trial. It's a lot of error. And some days are really, really frustrating. I just finished up a knife. I had to change the materials out so many different times because even though everything that I use goes through the drying process, it goes into the vacuum chamber and the resin and then the curing process, and then it's all individually placed with the exception of certain stones. It's not surefire, like, gonna work. So, like, horsehair sometimes, like, I've done 40 hours on these knives sometimes, and I get to the end and there's like a fucking horsehair that like won't stay down, you know? And I'm like, do I really have to like go through this whole hand sanding process again to do this? And so, you know, you figure out what works.
But maybe it was a difficult horse.
It probably was a very stubborn horse, I would imagine.
One of the things I love about your work, we talk about the handles, but we kind of talk about the blades too.
Yeah, for sure.
Because I love the rasp and file knives because it is baked on, you know, what we're talking about in terms of these found objects. You can see the fingerprint of where it came from. And I feel as though that a lot of these kind of rasps also have these amazing shape. They have these amazing, like, if there's, like, you know, these repeating patterns or these, you know, repeating semicircles sometimes. Mm-hmm. Once you grind it down, you have the history of the history of what it was for. The other thing I love is, and I think that it's very important in terms of your work, in my opinion, as a, you know, as now unofficial art, you know, reviewer, is that, you know, when you're using carbon steel in general, there is this degree of sacredness and maintenance. Mm-hmm. Because it changes over time. Right. And because if you leave a knife in a leather sheath and let's say it just gets a little bit damp, all of a sudden it's going to change. There is this degree of not permanence, which is very similar to your handles too. So there is this contrast between the steel and the handles. But I feel like I'm a stainless steel guy. I love stainless steel only because I feel as though for me as a knife maker, I'm trying to give a lot of my knives to people who are used to what they're used to and maybe be first-time knife buyers. Maybe they don't want to be precious with something. Right. And I always feel like when people use carbon steel, there's also this level of impermanence because it won't, over time, it is going to change.
Yeah, it certainly does change. I mean, it's been interesting trying to explain the patina that develops over time and the maintenance and, you know, how you have to take care of it. And no, these cannot go in the dishwasher. I find with high carbon steel, I haven't really worked with any stainless. I mean, there are times where I'll rehandle, you know, a knife that someone has given me that's stainless. But in terms of learning how to treat stainless steel, like, I'm like, now that I've got the handle stuff kind of under my belt, I'm diving deep into understanding more about the steel. And so I'm learning, you know, with like D2 and ADC or V2 and, you know, Nitro V and 1095, like they all interact a little bit differently. And then with stainless, you have this assurance, that it's not going to do what the high carbon steel does. But I kind of love watching the way it patinas and like what it does with it. But again, you know, that's not everybody's cup of tea. The rasps were really fun to do. I had done a collection for a really cool company called Ranchlands out in Colorado Springs. And so we were using Farrier's rasps from their property and materials from the property. And that was just, you know, kind of pulling it all together and how to, like, where do we source the steel from in order for it to fully tell the story, everything from steel to materials we use in the handles. And I was doing cheese knives for a little while with high carbon steel, and I decided that I'm going to start dabbling in other metals as well. So I've gotten my hands on a lot of brass and copper, and I have like a whole new machine to sort of melt everything down. And so I'm really sort of now moving into the alchemy of steel, and it's like opening up this whole other world of curiosity that I have. So this next year specifically, and as I travel, I'd really love to connect with other knife makers and blacksmiths, and there's just so much to learn. It's like never ending world of learning. And there's so much we can all learn from each other. So I'm excited to, as I travel and get to know all these different communities, to also connect with other local metal workers and start to dig really, really deep into understanding how the steel works as well, metal works as well.
If you're in Pennsylvania, you should try to make a pilgrimage to Center for Metal Arts.
I will.
Because in Johnstown. In Johnstown.
Okay.
So I'm going to go teach a class next. When this comes out, then following week, I'm going to be down there for a class. And what's interesting is, and something I talk about with Pat Quinn, the director, is how site influences the work. So it's an old, very old steel plant that they used to forge. They have these giant hammers, and they used to forge hooks and chains and all this. And it was incredible business, and there's so much history in these, in this facility, and how that site specific influenced Pat's work as a blacksmith and a toolmaker. Like that's what I find to be very interesting. Mm-hmm. But back to your rasps, there's like, it tells a story too, because I feel like I was really thinking about, you know, your handles and your knives as one. I love the dichotomy between a handle and a knife. I mean, my work is very much along the lines of the handles are usually the ones I like are bananas. And then the knives are like this kind of trying to be this crisp contrast or this juxtaposition between this kind of very planned out, but at the same time, to me, they're all fishing lures. Like for years, I made giant fishing lures and I loved fishing lures. And my sculpture for years were fishing lures because it was this idea of, well, it's hilarious because most fishing lures are meant to be, you think that they're meant to be for fish, but generally back in the day with the old Rapalas and stuff like that, they were really meant for fishermen to be in the store being like, oh man, that's going to kill it. Mm-hmm. So it's like you're more like you're catching the buyer than you are catching the fish.
Sure.
So my lures were always about the contrast between these carved wooden sculptures that were painted, heavily painted, with these contrasting with these, you know, diabolical steel hooks that I forged. And then the knives to me are, most of my knives I see as the same thing. It's this connection between the handles and the juxtaposition with the steel. And when I look at your horse, the rasp knives, I see a connection with those handles where there's wood from the trail or there's horsehair from the horse, and you're having this real connection in this conversation between the handles and the steel itself.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there's so many people who are so just drawn to, in the horse world specifically, you know, farriers rasps have just become something that you see it and you know exactly what it is. And so there's like this instant connection to it because of the patterns that are on it. At least for me anyway, and the clients that I've worked with who have requested farriers rasps for their steel, for their knives, it's like nostalgic. It's like you see a farrier's rasp, and if you're a horse owner, you think of a farrier coming in the sound that the farrier makes on the anvil, or the smell, or, you know, like being out on the open ranges with your horse or whatever it is that you're doing. It automatically, those patterns on that steel automatically evoke, for horse lovers, I think a whole world of, what comes with being a crazy horse, crazy horse person. Cause we certainly are a type, but the farrier's rasp again. Yeah. They're very nostalgic. And as I move into, you know, doing oyster shuckers and clam knives and things like that, I'm really excited to play with other types of steel, you know, that are more conducive to getting really, getting into different climates, you know, they're going to get a lot more wet than something that like an everyday carry that a cowboy would carry on his belt, you know.
I wonder how your future, you're not at the ranches anymore. I feel as though your time as a wrangler, as a ranch hand working on these ranches really informed not only the handles, but the steel. I'm wondering in the future, let's just pretend like you're not going to do horses anymore. Let's just, in our minds, we're going to pretend you're going to stay in the East Coast. I wonder how site specific is going to affect your upcoming work.
I think that it's. I mean, I'm hoping that, and the idea behind it is, it's all just an evolution. You know, I look back on some of the knives that I made in the beginning, and I'm like, wow, that was like really raw. I don't really know how else to explain it. Everything happened so quickly in terms of starting to make knives and then gaining some momentum. And, you know, I was dabbling with just doing rehandling pocket knives for a bit there during COVID because it opened up my, you know, client base and it made sense. And now that I'm getting back into the, now that I'm getting back into forging again, I'm as equally curious to see the evolution of all of that. I'm way more drawn now, I'm less drawn to like the raw live edge of the steel and like kind of like it telling me how it wants to look. And now I'm like, okay, like I want to get super clean with my work. I want it to be like so precise in the symmetry. I'd love to get like really, really into chef's knives and open up the ability to do the storytelling on all sorts of different knives and not just on, you know, EDCs or pocket knives. And so as I daydream a bit about what the evolution of the aesthetic looks like, I just see very sleek, not so maybe modern with like a little bit of classic, you know, traditional look to it. But I don't know. We're just going to have to see how it goes and how I'm moved to shape the steel especially as I learn more about it, you know, and why it does the way it does and how it needs to be treated and you know, different temperatures that it goes to shape it in the correct ways. And I don't know how it's all going to look, but that's like kind of the excitement behind it. It's just, yeah. It's a lot like the handles, you know, like I never really know what it looks like, but I do feel like there's a shift and a change in the way that I will present the steel side of my work moving forward.
It seems like it'll be appropriate based off of your experience. And I think that that's one of the things that when I think about Pat Quinn's work is I've seen his work before he moved down to Johnstown, and I've seen how the areas have affected, you know, how Johnstown has changed and evolved his work. And the same thing for me, like, I feel like when you're looking at an artist's work, you have to look at their body of work and where it came from. And I know the crazy part about knife making is like there's so many people who are like they hate looking at old knives. And it's because you've grown and you know that maybe you don't do them as thick as that way, or you figure out a new little trick that makes the belt finish look a little bit better, or maybe you've addressed some issues in regards to connections, or maybe your glue joints are different. There's so many different ways in which when you look at old knives, you think to yourself, oh, God, what an awful, don't show me that.
But look away.
But the problem is, as an artist, is you have to come to the mindset, and I think that comes with time, is you have to be able to look at it and see that as a milestone in your life.
Oh, totally.
And that this isn't like a computer program where you just upgrade the software. This is a milestone in the time of your life. And when I look at your work and I look at these, you know, beautiful, like, branches or cactuses or parts of, don't ask me, I'm from the South. Don't ask me, Kay. I don't know.
So you're doing great.
Cactuses.
You're
doing great. I don't know, but I'm just like, I look like a cactus. What the fuck do I know? I'm just saying that, like, you know, you've created this thing out west and based off of your experiences. And then now that you're back east and you're having these, I'm very excited to see how your work progresses, because that is the sign of an artist where. And I'm very tough on people calling themselves artists. Like, I come from a place of like, don't bullshit a bullshitter. Okay, I know all about it. I went to Blade Show. The first time I went to Blade Show, this guy comes up to me. I said, "Oh, I'm Jeff. How are you? I'm so and so." I said, "What do you do for a living?" So I'm a knife artist. And there are these artists who make sculptures out of knives. So in my mind, I'm thinking, "Whoa, guy's making sculptures out of, he's making these big sculptures, welding knives together. Oh, that's awesome." He's like, "No, I make knives." I'm like, "Oh, so you're a knife maker." He's like, "Oh, I'm a knife artist." I'm just like, these motherfuckers don't know what they're talking about. They're covering it up. So I started to get really like, I got to the point where I was like, some of you guys have got to be a little bit, you can't just say it. You got to be able to express it. If you don't express it, it doesn't give me, it gives me less hope. And then if you feel any degree of insincerity, you're out. That's my opinion. So what I'm interested in is I feel as though you have a compulsion to make work based off your experiences and the sights that you've seen. So
yes.
going to the beach, you're going to maybe find some, who knows, and sea urchins or something like that. You're going to throw them in there. Who knows?
It's yeah, just very toss exciting. It in, see what happens. And I think too, as I meet other artists or not artists, let's call them whatever.
Yeah, call them artists.
Yeah,
I don't call them. In my mind, I'm rolling my eyes. But you call them artists. Go
ahead. I can feel it. I don't know if it's in your mind because I definitely feel you rolling your eyes.
That's all right. Live and let live. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally. Okay. So I feel like based off of, I really don't want this to be, as I evolve and as I grow my business and I, launch a new brand called Legacy, which is a bold fucking statement. Like I was thinking about that the other day. I was like, wow, you're going to name a company and call it Legacy & Co. Like you better make sure you're executing this correctly. But the concept behind it is, as I evolve and grow as an artist, I am inspired by the way people create. And that kind of puts you into a place where it's like, well, we don't want to copy things and like, right. but I'm inspired. Oh, like, what do they say? What is that saying?
Comparison is the thief of joy.
Yeah, that. No, it's the opposite of that. It's like the highest form of flattery, but I'm forgetting the first word.
It's flattery is the most sincere form of flattery is the most sincere.
No, it's not flattery.
sarcasm is the lowest form of wit.
There we go. Sarcasm means to cut with the tongue, as my mother always reminds me.
Gonna say I know what it is. Don't worry.
You know it. I'm sure whoever's listening knows.
Oh, yeah. Sincerest form. This is a
imitation. Imitation is the highest
flattery.
No, imitation is the highest form of flattery.
That's right. So imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. Good job, Kay Foy.
Yeah, but it's also really pisses me off. So I want to, as I travel, and I just don't want this to be. I don't even have a maker's mark on my stuff. I don't want this to be this is my knife and what I'm doing. I want it to be inspired. I don't want to imitate, but I do want to be inspired. I want to learn. I'll never be the highest in terms of knowledge. I'll never know everything. And I kind of love that. And so as I travel and I collect materials and I speak to people and hear their stories, it's also equally as important that I'm connecting with other artisans. Can I call them that?
Of course. Call them whatever you want. Okay. Don't worry about what I think about what you have to say. I don't give a shit.
Totally.
Call whatever you want.
So other artists and other creators and others, bladesmiths and all the people who do all the things who make things. I'm inspired by tools that have function and purpose. And as I evolve and as my knives evolve and as this whole concept of storytelling and using tools, we'll just call them tools, as a canvas to do that, I would love to expand into creating all sorts of different things, whether that's flatware and I'm doing butter knives and forks and spoons but learning from other makers or having them be involved and created in that creative in that process, maybe where we come together and they do the belt buckles or the rings or the spoons or the forks or whatever it is. And then it's kind of coming together for everybody to tell the story. I think what I'm trying to say is it doesn't have to just be this is what Kay made, but it's right. We all have something to offer. We all want to tell a story. And so how do we kind of come together and collaborate and learn from one another and inspire one another to be able to do that in a way that no one's imitating one another. We're just pushing one another to learn more and do things a little differently and see outside the box. We can get stuck in our little shop boxes sometimes.
Inspiration is supposed to make you excited to work. It isn't. Inspiration is not supposed to be copying. That's right. Really. I worked for a steel sculptor, and he felt like he was not getting fired up enough, he would take us to the museum. And then we'd leave the museum, he'd be like, I'm filled with inspiration. And inspiration was he wasn't going to knock somebody off. He was going to inspired to get moving on his own work and finding and working on his own voice.
Yeah.
Tell me more about Legacy & Co. Very excited about this new opportunity.
Yeah. So this has been a passion project of mine. It developed back in, it came to life with this concept, a very small concept, back in 2022. And I was thinking a lot about how I was going to create a better business model for myself, because, you know, it's hard. It's hard being an artist and also an entrepreneur. And what I found was that I did a better job of running my business when I would allocate time to creating the collection and then selling the collection. So like, I wasn't creating, doing the website, marketing, customer service, packaging, you know, all of the things at once. And so the business model sort of turned into, okay, like let's create collections, and then we'll have time to do all of the things. And when I say we, I mean me, myself, and I. And so the first collection that I will be creating, and this was before Legacy became like the concept, but it's a collection for a new beginning. And so like I'd gone through some things in my life, and I was kind of ready for like a refresh. And I really wanted that to show up in my work. And so this collection for a new beginning, which was very much inspired by Gustav Klimt and him using gold, like weaving gold in his work. But then also the Japanese philosophy of kintsugi. And so it's like taking these broken pieces of things, specifically pottery is where the philosophy came from. For those who might not be familiar with it, in the Japanese culture, when pottery breaks, precious metals, specifically gold, tend to be used to bind the pottery back together. And what's really beautiful about that is actually those breaks and putting it all back together binds it in a way that it actually makes it stronger than it was to begin with. And it also makes it really unique, and it tells its like individual story.
And it's a very time-consuming process.
Very time-consuming. But my process is already time-consuming. So, like, let's just make it more difficult.
Well, I just don't... People should know that it's not just, like, getting some crazy glue.
Sticking
it together. It's, like, drying in months and months and months. And, like, these very intricate repairs are, like, you know, could be, like, months.
Right. Yeah, it is. I've tried to do it on pottery. I'm like, well, if I'm going to do this on knives, I totally need to, like, do this on pottery. And... It gets you to the point where you're like, I might just take this and throw this against the wall, and then it's going to be impossible for me to fix it.
Don't do it.
So it's cool. so with that collection and that idea and that business model of creating collections, I got to thinking about life, and I got to thinking about being a creative who uses, you know, their talent to make money and what that means, and like, is that my legacy? And you know, there were parts of as a human, there are parts of me that was showing up in the world in a way that I was like, oh, I could be better at that. Like, you know, we all have room to grow and learn. And I have also the privilege of hearing parts of my clients' stories that their legacy is woven into the handles as well. I mean, they're called legacy knives. That's what I call them, legacy knives. So as I'm contemplating my own new beginning, and I'm contemplating how to be a better business owner, and I'm contemplating how to be a better human and all those things, I had this idea that, well, maybe rather than doing all of this, all these collections under my name, that it would be under Legacy & Co. is the name of the brand that I will hopefully be launching later this spring, early summer. And the concept behind it is that it becomes an umbrella brand to bring other artists in who want to also do storytelling with their own mediums. And so like while I'm doing my knife collections and things like that and telling legacy, you know, sharing legacies and telling stories, that there's room for other creatives and artists and all of the people to kind of come in and do it as well. So it can be like a bigger brand, hopefully someday. But it also leaves me time to just work on collections, and then I can sell. And it's not just it's not just me that's doing it. You know, I can eventually have an apprentice and, you know, build something that's like a little bit outside of just me and the shop and telling stories. Because I think there's a lot of us that want to tell stories. And I want to have a place in a space where other artists can come in and do it too. So it's very, it's like a very beginning concept of how it could potentially show up later on in the world. We'll see how it all shakes out. But
it sounds exciting.
Yeah, it sounds confusing as I'm saying it out loud.
No,
but
it doesn't sound confusing. It doesn't sound confusing to me. I mean, it doesn't sound confusing at all. It's almost going to be like a gallery.
Yeah, well, yeah, yeah. But it also, you know, with like traveling to all these different places, you know, I've thought about going to Argentina and Australia. And so if I'm traveling to all these places and I'm building these collections and it's under the Legacy & Co. name, then I think it makes more sense to the consumer and to whoever's observing this or wants to purchase, or if we want to put in a gallery or something like that, that it's just a brand that tells stories, is really truly what it all comes down to.
So what's next for KFOY?
Oh gosh. Well, that's a great question. Later on today, I don't even
all
know.
Right, you want to go minutia? We go minutia. It's fine.
I have some knives to finish. Okay. I will be here in Pennsylvania with my family until June, and then I'll be making my way up. I think I've got it figured out in Maine. Still have a couple things that I need to put into place, but it's looking like I'll be up in Maine until September. And so I will just start working on some kind of beachy collection and figuring out how I'm going to get Legacy off the ground and then off to New Mexico in the fall. And I'll be doing like a Southwestern collection out there. And then maybe Australia, January through March, 2026.
Amazing.
We'll see. You know, life happens but for sure, for now, definitely New England this summer and then Santa Fe in the fall. So just lots of different collections are on their way and a lot of commissions I got to finish. So
fantastic. Fantastic. KFOY. I'm so glad you're here. I've been a fan for such a long time, and to be able to talk to you and kind of allow you, thank you for your generosity in terms of your time and your flexibility in terms of time, but thank you for being as straightforward as fascinating as, you know, you couldn't have asked for a better guest. I mean, you're always welcome back. Next time you come
thank
back,
you.
We'll fuck around.
You yeah, know? Let's fuck around next time.
Yeah, next time. This was the origin story. I had to just like, you know, we had to shake the cobwebs out and, you know, let people know how it is. But next time you come on, we'll fuck around.
I'm definitely ready for that.
I'm very appreciative of you being here, and I'm very, very – you're an incredible voice in a community that needs a voice like yours.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here, and for you, I know you're busy too, so thank you for carving out the time.
Are you crazy? I'm with you. Guys, I want you to go follow KFOY. I want you to go follow the Legacy & Co. If you look down in the show notes, there's going to be links to her Instagram, her website, and Legacy & Co. So once again, KFOY, thank you so much for being here. I've been a fan for such a long time, and it was really great to chat with you, and thank you so much.
No, thank you. We'll fuck around soon.
I'm with you. Guys, we're going to see you next week. Thanks again.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.